Today on Straight Talk Africa, what does Africa need to develop and improve the quality of life of the vast majority of her people? Strong men or strong institutions? That discussion is coming up next, right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheka Sali. Today we are discussing whether Africa needs strong leaders or strong institutions to make the lives of its citizens better. In the 1990s, many African countries embraced presidential term limits and building institutions as a transition to democracy. But in recent years, term limits and institutions are under attack from incumbent presidents seeking to prolong their tenure. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
In his farewell speech in July 2015, former U.S. President Barack Obama, while speaking to a large audience at the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa, hailed Africa's extraordinary progress, noting that such growth can only be sustained through continued development and democracy for all.
When I first came to sub-Saharan Africa as a president, I said that Africa doesn't need strong men, it needs strong institutions.
Constitutional engineering to remove or circumvent presidential term limits and undermining institutions by some leaders is alarming. For example, in Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi, incumbent presidents have exploited ambiguities in the law to extend their terms as heads of state while simultaneously undermining their nation's constitution. Equatorial Guinea's President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasogo has held power for 39 years. He's still going strong, winning a fifth seven-year term in 2016. Earlier this month, Cameroon's President Paul Biya was sworn in after winning 71% of the vote in the October election, extending his 36-year rule. In 2008, the Cameroonian parliament voted to change the constitution to remove term limits so President Paul Biya would be eligible to extend his time in office. In December 2017, Uganda's parliament voted to lift the age limit for the presidency, setting a stage for the nation's longtime leader, Yoweri Museveni, to rule indefinitely. President Museveni successfully pushed to change the constitution in 2005 to abolish term limits. Rwandan President Paul Kagame won his last election in 2017 with nearly 100% of the vote, securing a third term in office. Kagame's re-election came after a constitutional amendment which ended a two-term limit, allowing him to possibly remain in power until 2034. In Burundi, voters overwhelmingly approved a new constitution, extending the presidential term from 5 to 7 years, potentially allowing President Pierre Nkurunziza to seek two more terms beginning in 2020. Political analysts argue that perhaps former U.S. President Barack Obama was right when he said that democracy in Africa is threatened when the presidents do not stand aside at the end of their constitutional term limits.
I am in my second term, but under our constitution, I cannot run again. And no one person is above the law, not even the president.
On a positive note, not all of Africa is dealing with the strongman syndrome. For example, new Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is proposing and pushing through reforms. In a historic move, the Prime Minister swore in the country's first female president, Supreme Court judge, and named 10 female ministers to his cabinet, which is now a split equally between men and women. In West Africa, opposition leader Julius Maada Bio was sworn in as president of Sierra Leone in April, replacing incumbent Ernest Bai Koroma, who abided by the country's constitution and stepped down as head of state. In January 2018, George Weah, a former international football star, was sworn in as president of Liberia, following incumbent President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who stepped down at the end of her second constitutionally allowable term. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that interesting report. Joining us here in our Washington, D.C. studio is our distinguished guest, a former ambassador of the Republic of Benin to Washington, Omar Haruna.
Hello, Shaka.
Hello, how are you, Omar?
Doing great. How are you?
I am hugely terrific, and it's a great pleasure to meet you again.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. We expect to be joined later by another guest, Mary Wera, coordinator with Watch Democracy Grow, the U.S. chapter. And you heard, of course, the clip. What do you think? You come from a very interesting country that experienced for a very, very long time a strong man,
yes,
by Matthew Kareku.
Definitely, indeed. You know, when we talk about strong men, I think we need to nuance that. Strong men has to be followed with a strong moral compass. And that's the issue with our governance in Africa. In the time of Kareku, it was probably appropriate because we're coming from a tumultuous time in the country, in Benin. And we move into a situation where the country needs to be built. And to build strong institution, you need to have a strong man to build strong institution. So we cannot dissociate. It's not all game. We cannot dissociate the fact that to build a strong institution, we need strong men. So therefore, I cannot say that we need only strong men to build Africa. No, but we also need strong men to build strong institution with. Those women has to have moral compass.
What about some who say, on the contrary, what you really need is a society that is socially and politically conscious?
I agree. But let me just give you an example. Let's say in some of our countries, we have institutions such as the Constitutional Court, where there's the court of the last resort when it comes to electoral issues. The fact is that that court is not supposed to be infallible. However, that court supposed to, if people have to have trust enough to the court, into the court, to a point where they realize that they may not be infallible, but this is the buck stop at this court. So, meaning what? That the strength of an institution is not the infallibility of that institution. However, is the trust and the belief that the citizen have into that institution, saying that they're doing the best that they could under the circumstance, and that we know that most of the time they get it right.
What about the fact that if you look at each of the countries in Africa,
yes,
you look at their constitutions,
mm-hmm,
you'll find that each of them, at least on paper, they have three equal branches of government.
Yes.
They have the executive branch. They are led by a president or a prime minister.
Correct.
They have the judiciary
branch,
led by the chief justice or president of the court. And they have a legislature.
Correct.
Led by a speaker or, in your particular case, a president.
A president.
What happens when these three branches are in operation? Because a lot of times, two of the branches, the judicial branch,
mm-hmm,
and the legislature, seem to play a subordinate role to the executive.
Exactly. I think we have that currently in one of my countries. And the fact is that, that's why I'm going back to the fact that we need strong people to run those institutions. Because institution is made of people.
Made of people.
And if those people don't have the moral compass, they don't have the framework that guide them in relation to human rights? Obviously, yes, they will be subordinate to the stronger institution. Let us assume that in the case, the president's office is the strongest institution. Obviously, all the other core branch of government will want to alienate themselves to the president's office because they do not have the moral compass to say that we are an independent branch of government and we have a duty not to the president's office but to the population.
Wait a minute, Omar. We're talking about a society.
Yes.
That is supposed to be a society of laws.
Laws.
Not men,
correct.
Not women.
Correct. But law reposes on what? Law is not made in a just in space.
In a vacuum.
In a vacuum. Mm. Law is made for people. And people, and what makes a law strong is the ability of the people to abide by that particular law. So therefore, we put together institutions that have law. Most of the institutions in Africa, they have good law in the book. But those laws are followed?
The implementation.
And
execution.
That's where the problem is. To execute, it's just like an enterprise, a private enterprise. If you don't have a good leadership, you can have the best idea or the best law in your book. It's not going to work. We have to implement the idea. We have to apply ourselves, and that's where we lack.
But what do you mean by good leadership? I mean,
good
you
leadership.
Have, if you, you are a president, you are in charge of the executive,
mm-hmm.
you are supposed to uphold the law of the land.
You are supposed. That's
yes.
the operating word, supposed. But most of our leaders, unfortunately, they don't. They uphold their own law. They lost their moral compass to a point where only thing that is of interest to them is to remain in power. And that's why you see that most of the African countries, once they can be democratically elected, but once they come to power, they try to change the constitution so they can remain as long as they can. They don't realize that the same law that put you in there, if you don't strengthen those laws, you will not be able to basically do what they elect you to do.
What about some who say that the only reason the individual who is in charge of the executive appears to be strong is because that particular individual uses the military, uses the security forces, and also his control over the treasury?
Yes, I think the latter is probably the most important. The control over the treasury.
To compromise people.
And that's what it is. We talk about it, corruption.
And the control of the means of violence.
Violence.
Intimidation.
I mean, it's happening every day in some of the country that we perceive to be a democratic country because we forget that an election doesn't make democracy. It's a part of a process. And the election, once you elect them and they appear to be democratically elected, when they're in office, what they do is much more important than the way they arrive there. And we've seen it many times. And most of those strong leaders that come in power, they say, we have been democratically elected. And under that cover, they're worse than dictatorial regimes, basically. Yes, definitely. I think we need to look at institution and the leadership as a two-face of the same coins. Because once you have, if you don't have a strong institution, then the leadership can take advantage of it. However, to build a strong institution, you need somebody who has a strong leader, who has the will, who is a builder. Because you cannot build, especially in Africa, if you are weak, you cannot build an institution. So you have to have that. But the only thing that usually miss from all that ingredient is the moral compass of our leader. Our leader have to understand that they're not in it for themselves. They're in it for the elector. They're in it for the peoples. I think that's the most important part. And that's why I'm saying that we cannot dissociate strong leadership from a strong institution. They want it, they go hand to hand. But that's what we can say. People, we want to make sure that we choose the right moral leaders.
What about the issue of a population that is socially and politically conscious, politically aware of its rights? Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference?
It does make a lot of difference.
How?
It makes a difference because they push back. You know, most of the country, especially in a country such as mine, we like to push back. And that's how democracy works. Democracy is not a peaceful state of mind where you listen to your leader and then you don't question your leader. As a matter of fact, you have to question leaders. So a country has to be, people have in the country have to be socially conscious of their rights. And that's where I think it's also part of leadership. You know, leadership is not at the top. It's also at the bottom. So we need the young people to cultivate that leadership capability, the ideal of leaderships. And it goes throughout the society. Because you will see, actually, that most of the society where the people are not conscious, socially conscious of their right, the leader is more have the more tendency to do whatever they want to because they know there is not going to be a pushback.
Let's see, let's talk about your particular country, Benin.
Benin.
Who is in charge of Benin? Is it, and in fact, what I'm asking is, who is the primary stakeholder in Benin? Is it the people or is it the president?
I used to think it was the people, but now I think, I wonder. I wonder because the direction the country is taking is, quite interesting. You know, we were known to be the, I would think, the cradle of democracy in Africa.
Correct.
And all of a sudden, we elected 2.5 years ago a president who was democratically elected, overwhelmingly elected. But I think he lost the moral compass.
You're talking about Patrice Talon?
I'm talking about President Talon.
A man who comes from the business background?
Yes, and I think that's a mistake.
Something, in fact, he has something in common with our president here.
I think they
Donald
have too
Trump.
Much in common.
Really?
They have too much in common. They both were businessmen, and both of them have cannot dissociate their business from the patrimony of the country. And for what is worth saying, in the case of Benin, we overlook the fact that. We build strong institutions in the country, but we've overlooked the fact that it can only take somebody who really did not care about those institutions to destroy the whole work that was done.
What happened to the once vibrant civil society in Benin?
Well, I would think that the civil society is still vibrant, but they're fearful. Because the strong men in the marina have put fear into them. That's one thing. The civil society in Benin also have been corrupted by the top leadership. This is unfortunate. I mean, I should be sitting here and praising the country. But unfortunately, we are in a situation where the country is going to the wrong direction, and we need to pull back.
A country that you loyally represented as its ambassador for many years.
Yes, and you know what? Sometimes I think about it and I say to myself, I think we shoot ourselves in the foot because we did the good work so much to present Benin in the eyes of the international as being a democratic country to a point where people are not looking at it for what it is now, meaning that we shoot ourselves in the foot by pushing too much that rhetorical about a narrative about a good democratic country. It was a good democratic country. Institutions were being built But however, it's taken one man to destroy all those institutions.
But how could that be when Benin, I am told, at least people consider themselves to be citizens who owe allegiance to the state and know that they do have constitutional rights. In fact, inalienable rights, one could even say birthrights, as opposed to being subjects who owe allegiance to an individual authority who have no constitutional rights, but in fact expect privileges which are handed to them from that particular individual authority.
I think poverty is the issue, really. When people don't have what to eat, they pledge allegiance to who can or who they perceive can feed them.
But the people are supposed to be the bosses. They are supposed to be in charge of the president and many public officials.
We have the judiciary in Benin. We have parliament in Benin. But if I tell you that as currently in Benin, the head of the constitutional court is the private lawyer of the president of the country.
How does that happen?
Isn't that
an apparent conflict of interest?
It is an apparent conflict of interest, but it's a perception issue because the moment that, as a former lawyer of the president, you defend the president and you became the head of the foremost institution in the country, people tied you to the president. And the perception of that institution take a hit because people wonder, can we trust this institution?
Really?
That's the question. I can give you many examples. The parliament is under the spell of the president.
So, as I said a little bit earlier, you are talking about parliament, for example, being subordinate to the executive.
To the executive by money. I mean, I was listening to a show last week, or maybe early this week, I can't remember. And one of the parliament, the oldest parliamentarian, she was saying clearly that I was given $5 million francs CFA from the Minister of Finance so I could vote the change of the constitution. I didn't say that. That lady said that, which is the former wife of the former president. And she's one of the oldest parliamentarians in Benin.
Really?
So when you hear things like that, you wonder. Money has become the king in that politics.
Well, I'm delighted to announce that the other distinguished guest, Mary Wera, the pure one, who is a coordinator with Watch Democracy Grow, the United States chapter, has arrived and is with us right here.
Thank you, Shaka, for having me.
You're most welcome. Sorry for having had to negotiate the midday Washington traffic.
Thank you.
How are you?
Good. And you?
Good. You look terrific.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, when you look at the topic that we are discussing, what do you think is better for Africa? Is it strong men? And you happen to come from Rwanda, which has the distinction of, at least according to a lot of pundits, who have a strong man? Or does it in fact need strong institutions?
I guess, Shaka, sometimes it becomes a challenge because when you look at the history, either US or even Africa, strong men have led to some development. Independence of Africa was achieved because of Kwame Nkrumah, people like Patrick Lumumba, people like Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. So yes, you need strong men to some degree to champion certain political culture. When you look at US, we have people like George Washington, the first president here. We have Madison, who championed the political culture of democracy. But again, as he said, Madison, truth be told, when power is in the hands of men, then we should not really trust those men. Therefore, a need to do a check and balance. And he goes on actually to say that accumulation of power, be it legislature, executive, or judiciary, in the hands of either one, a few, or even many, by any means, hereditary, selective, appointed, it prones the nation itself for tyranny. Therefore, there is a need to have strong institutions, yes, much as we may need strong men, but power corrupts. Therefore, we need a check and balance.
And absolute power does what?
It corrupts.
Absolutely.
So basically, on the continent of Africa, where we have corruption, we have, in the real sense, the democracy we talk of, it's not as it is here. Like I was watching these elections which have been going on, rarely do you see an opponent party occupying the other part of the parliament. But here it happens. We have Democrats really occupying the Congress, the House of Representatives. So for us, we haven't reached there.
Well, of course, you really cannot generalize Africa, because there are some countries in Africa which actually reflect that.
Yeah.
South Africa, for example. It can even recall an incumbent president without completing his tenure. And they have not only recalled one, but in fact two, time I checked.
Do you know why they are able to do that? Because of strong institutions, separation of power. Literally, there is no way executive party is going to corrupt judiciary. There is no way they are going to corrupt the parliament. Those institutions are independent.
And even the ruling party itself, the ANC, is in fact democratic.
Sure. So basically, if you really you are looking for promoting a healthy democracy, you need strong institutions. But remember again, strong institutions are built by strong leaders.
Very interesting. What about in some cases where some have argued that you have some uniquely gifted individuals who can make a difference?
That argument, I don't really tend to buy it, because if you talk of uniquely gifted people, I tend to relate to George Washington, who forged a nation out of blue. But he was like, I'm going to say, just to be there.
But he did not do it alone.
Exactly, with others. But he said, well, despite that I have shaped this culture, I'm just going to be there for only two terms. If maybe the other person comes and fails, maybe call me back. But at least let's give a chance to other people. So we wouldn't have got people like Thomas Jefferson. We wouldn't have got
Abraham
other people.
Abraham Lincoln.
Very good. Exactly, Abraham Lincoln. So literally, there shouldn't be one person to say that is the only person who can champion this nation. There are always, we couldn't have known that existed if a chance was not given. So you give others, and then you know their capacity.
Yeah, but what about the people themselves? I mean, it's not about, it shouldn't be dependent on the individual person who happens to occupy State House.
Mm-hmm.
It should be about the people themselves. If you look, for example, at the referendum in Rwanda, it's almost like a perfect referendum.
That one, there are two usual definitions of democracy. There is the normal or formal one, which is a government of people, by the people, for the people. And there is another one suggested by Joseph, if I remember, which is institutional arrangement for arriving to power. Yeah. So literally what happened in Rwanda was an institutional arrangement to arrive to power, but not the normal way as we know it, that people should champion, really, that constitution because under normal circumstances, why would you change it?
Do you agree with some people who have said that it was, as a matter of fact, pressure from what they call the political military pressure?
I would say yes. And again, that's where our communities tend to be blind. If you think of a nation growing in terms of leadership and terms of democracy, I don't think that was a brilliant approach, because no matter how much you manipulate, time comes you can't be able to, and you end up putting a country in a context where it wouldn't have been, especially if you consider where it is now. So the question is, why really change, especially that they had even different people who could have served much or even in the same way as the president? So yes, there was that pressure in the real sense, which was not fair to the president himself, because by the end of the day, the mistakes which come, we don't attribute it to the party, we attribute it to an individual. Mm-hmm. So it's not fair, really, to the candidate himself.
Why? Couldn't he have declined, for example?
That is exactly what I'm saying. That is a way, again, you tend to not understand the notion of power corruption.
Or did he, in fact, succumb to the people's pressure
to the
as some of the individuals in the Great
Could
Lake
be, I don't said. Know. Could be, I would say maybe he succumbed. But again, that's where you, if you really stand your independent mind, you are like, no, this is not healthy because of ABCD, I decline. He
but
had
Mary,
that chance.
Mary, surely there must be something going on in Rwanda because there is a saying, you know, and a lot of people agree that there is no smoke without fire.
Mm-hmm.
There must be something because I run into a lot of people mm-hmm. who give me the example of Rwanda
mm-hmm.
as the country on the right track.
Yeah, actually.
And yet this is a country that is clearly undemocratic. This is a country where people do not have the fundamental rights, for example, of expressing themselves freely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we are told that the president, Major General Paul Kagame, retired but not tired, is working miracles.
Usually when you come into leadership in a country, especially when you consider the history of Rwanda, 1994 genocide, that is a turmoil. So you come in and you are trying to move things to the right track. There is always an overrating of that credit in the real sense, which makes him look like he has done a lot in the country.
But has the issue of that genocide,
mm-hmm.
how it came about,
mm-hmm.
the fundamental causes of it and what have you, has in fact that issue been resolved?
Not really. I would say, yeah, there is some kind of reconciliation which is going on. But again, remember, genocide is not a product of people themselves. It's a product of poor leadership. My worry is that if it is not well championed or monitored in terms of changing the ideologies that caused the genocide, which in any case would be exclusion in power, which is now also happening. We may not have genocide, but we may have again another resentment and another again kind of conflict. So on that notion, I say, much as he has had a credit for having helped the country, I think if you just see in the interest of the growth of a nation politically and in terms of leadership, and actually rebuilding that reconciliation for even the country, I think it would be better for him to totally hand over the power. Because at this material time, despite that he's popular internationally, and by the way, the development of Rwanda, I would also say, it's not from him alone. We had a lot of international favoritism due to the international guilt after genocide, whereby all the international communities were like, oh, we are not there during that time. Therefore, it's time now to build the country. We had debt forgiveness.
I'm afraid we'll come back to that later because time happens not to be best ally.
Thank you.
You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment. So please don't go away because we'll be right back with you.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices. table to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
A reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, and you can also watch us live on your mobile device. Just unload the VOA mobile app now. Let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, new Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power promising to rein in the security services, tackle economic mismanagement, fight corruption and human rights abuses. Abiy is pushing through reforms, reversing decades-old policies. An in-depth discussion on Ethiopia's new era on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are discussing whether Africa needs strong leaders or strong institutions to make the lives of its citizens better. Our guests are Mary Uwera, coordinator with Watch Democracy Grow, the U.S. chapter, and Ambassador Omar Haruna, who is former ambassador of the Republic of Benin to the United States. I have to say, Mary and Omar, it's a pleasure, of course, always to have you here on the show, and I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to be able to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, Chaka.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you, Mary, again. I just wanted to make it very clear. Mm-hmm. The question I asked you earlier really was not about what is being done today, whether there has been reconciliation or no reconciliation. That is a subject for debate. The question, in fact, I was alluding to is, do we sincerely know who triggered the genocide?
Like in any civil war, various factors lead to an incident. You cannot attribute to one factor. There was a discontent inside. There was the invasion of RPF. And all those contributed to the issue of genocide.
What about the plane?
Of course, the plane is part of it. Since the negotiations were not going to be underway...
No, negotiations had actually been completed in Arusha.
Yes, they had been completed in Arusha.
There was a deal for...
But they were not going to be in place. Like, they were not going to be implemented, according to Habyarimana. So,
Wait a minute. In fact, some aspects were already in place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why, for example, the RPF soldiers were already in the capital, Kigali.
Mm-hmm.
You had a battalion which was stationed in what was the parliamentary building, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that was part of the Arusha deal.
Yes, but having the military or the battalion in Kigali never meant that really... there was going to be immediate repatriation of the people. And I think there was that kind of disagreement that a possibility that may not take place. So I don't know how the plane crashed. At that time, I was in Uganda, actually, as a student.
Now, wait a minute. You obviously have had the benefits of hindsight.
Uh-huh.
You have read a lot that has been written on that subject.
Uh-huh.
Not only in terms of commentators, but also books.
Yeah.
You have even had films. So surely you should be in a position by now
to
be reasonably reasonably aware of what happened or what didn't happen.
Usually, Chaka, if I don't have evidence, I don't like to hypothesize or kind of speculate that it was this. All I know was what ended up, the end result of the negotiation was the plane crash. And here we see genocide, which makes me actually say that before even the plane had not crashed, I think genocide was going to take place because following the magnitude, following the way it was implemented, that was not accidental. So whether the plane was going to crash or whether it was not going to crash, I think it would be fair to say genocide was going to happen in any way. Otherwise, where did people get the pangas? Where did people get organized on that last minute of plane crash? So,
do you have evidence of that?
I mean, people were being killed openly. I mean, that's something which was out there.
Well, the thing is, you said earlier that there was a civil war.
Yeah. But how could civilians possess the machetes?
But let me ask you a
question. In a short period of the plane crash.
Do you believe, for example, that President Kagame stopped genocide?
Yes. In fairness to him, really, I would always be...
What about critics who say, on the contrary, he may, in fact, have been behind triggering the genocide? In fact, some of the evidence has come from some individuals who were very, very close comrades and allies of President Kagame.
Let me tell you, sometimes I like to be open on certain things and not to be biased. I don't see of what benefit was he going to benefit from the genocide. First of all, ask yourself, why would he champion genocide? It became as an accidental, just like the World War. You would not say one factor led to the happening of World War and Second War. It was a trigger for genocide. But I don't think he really had that interest of genocide. No, that would be not fair.
I have to, there's no democracy in Studio 47. If you are told by the producer to go, you have to go.
Okay.
And I'm told one of our followers on social media just sent us a video with a question. Let's take a look.
Hello, Shaka. This is Guy Fleury from Burundi, but I live in Washington. My question to you is, don't you think that in some cases African nations need a strong man to bring strong institutions?
Very interesting. How would you react to that, Omar? You already actually, I think, said something to that effect.
Yes, we do need, because institutions don't build themselves. And you have to have will to build your institution. So therefore, yes, we do need strong men to build institution, not to become the institution. There is a nuance.
But is it only a man? What about the women?
Yes, obviously. As a matter of fact, I would think that women are better leaders than men most of the time.
Especially our mothers.
I would think women are better leaders than men of the time. But when we say men, we're talking about strong leaders, really. In Africa, what a problem is, I think I'll say it again, we have all the best will possible, but we lose our moral compass on our way to the goal. And most of our leaders, they will come mostly with a good intention. But once they're sitting in that chair, they realize that they could do better for themselves. So they lose the common purpose.
Interesting. Now, Mary.
Yes, please.
There is this guy, Francis Egu Lansana from Liberia. His question is it possible to have strong, good leaders without strong institutions?
In the first instance, a good leader or a strong leader will build strong institutions. So if you have a good leader, definitely should be able to have strong institutions. I'll set an example of the current Prime Minister of Ethiopia. You can see, at least, although he's just coming in shortly, but at least he's able to build here and there. So definitely the number one thing you will be able to see if a leader is good is if they are championing the building or the building of institutions.
You're talking about
Abiy Ahmed. Yes, yeah, Prime Minister Abiy. So
he seems to be like a bridge builder and not a wall builder.
Correct.
He seems to be a reconciler.
Mm-hmm.
He also seems, frankly, to believe in openness.
Yeah, sure.
In transparency.
So based on him, on his example, you can see at least how if you have a good leader, you are most likely to have good institutions. If you don't have a good leader, you are most likely not to have good institutions. And the issue is one, because institutions challenge the leaders. So leaders usually don't want to build what is going to challenge them.
But what about the idea that it is not really the individual of the leadership, that it has to be the people, really, that leadership has to come from the people, and that these people must be socially and politically aware of their rights.
True.
And they must therefore assert them.
That takes me to the notion of Africa in comparison to you, to the West. The West have, the people have already built their political awareness and their rights. They are able to stand and really advocate for them.
It wasn't always like that in the West.
Exactly.
You are talking about the recent West.
Exactly. So they
had... Because where did the mother of all two world wars, in fact, come from? From the failure of leadership.
I know.
In Europe.
I know.
World War One, World War Two.
Yeah, that's true. And that's why we say, actually, democracy is a process. Mm-hmm. It's not something that is just going to be out. It's a process. You build it. So basically, right now, we can start building the people on the continent. And actually, that goes to why within this year, I would say this is an opportunity for Africa to build the capacity of their people. Because at least in the 1960s, we were independence, which was achieved. Then we have military coups. Then we
what
are now
of
struggling.
What independence were you talking about?
At least
there are some people who actually regard that as flag independence.
You know, whatever case
it was. National anthem type of independence.
Kind of, but at least it managed to say to bring an image whereby Africa was no longer subjected to imperialism. So basically there was some kind of independence there. So I think now...
You mean colonialism?
Colonialism, really? That I would say.
Because apparently
sometimes
the last time
I
checked imperialism...
When I say colonialism, it's more stigmatic than actual imperialism. Because imperialism is somehow friendly. Colonialism is another word that I usually don't
imperialism
intend.
Is somewhat friendly? What do you mean?
Kind of compared to colonialism.
Wait a minute. I thought that, in fact, if there is anybody who probably has defined this... phenomenon you are talking about best is someone that you actually fondly referred to earlier in the program.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Ghanaian founding leader, the Osage Four, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah.
Correct.
He talked, in fact, he even didn't talk, he even wrote a book. He said basically imperialism is the last stage
of colonialism.
Yeah. But the issue is that you can get rid of imperialism, but you cannot get rid of colonialism.
Now, wait
and
a minute.
That's why we are having even what we are having today, for sure.
Wait a minute.
Because the neo-colonialism...
Would you like to wait, please?
Yes, I think what she's trying to say is that we've seen the face of colonialism, and we do not know the face of imperialism.
Very good.
That's
very
basically
good.
What she said.
That is, imperialism actually can be invincible.
Very good. Yes. But colonialism, it's, even right now, we have it amongst our own. So, Richard...
Yes, it is a mindset.
No, I don't think it is... Well, yes, in a way you could say that, but in fact, guess who is, in fact, operating imperialism in our midst? It is our brothers and sisters who are agents of it.
Correct.
The Swahili have a word called nyampara.
See? So it's invisible, in other words.
Well, it may be invisible in some ways, but it is actually very, very visible.
And which actually worries me.
What do you think a person like, for example, Mobutu Sese Seko was a banger, represented in the Congo for over 30 years?
You know, one thing we have to be sincere about is that those leaders who came after independence, they were not independent themselves. Mm-hmm. So basically, that's, again, the other invisible hand, which I'm saying, we were able to get rid of imperialism, but we had not yet ended the colonialism. So he represented definitely the masters, people even... Actually, even when you talk of Kwame Nkrumah himself, people will tell you that that very birth of African Union, that was the failure of democracy at the very beginning, because the very day they were launching independence struggle, that was the very day he was imprisoning political parties in his country. A lot of
not
people.
Not imprisoning political parties, but oppositions. Leaders.
Exactly.
Political parties.
So, yeah, which is oppositions. So if he had championed that together with the independence, probably wouldn't be having what we are struggling. That's, again, the other school of thought. They usually say, you know what, if maybe he had been able to champion that one together with independence, maybe we would be far away. Maybe even African Union would have been able to be more proactive.
You know, there is a saying that all of life is about passion, action, and reaction. And that to ignore the passion, action, and reaction of your generation is to risk having not really lived at all, occupying space. To what extent do you think that these changing demographics, the young people, in tandem with social media, which can expose them incredibly, is going to make a difference in terms of bringing about the badly needed fundamental changes on the African continent?
To a bigger extent, I think the youth and young people are really now taking it on. They have been, like, if I would use the word obedience, enough to the leaders. But again, now they are realizing that it's high time they got involved. And that's why we actually say this is maybe, in my view, this is a time for young generation to start building the civil society, start building those institutions we are talking about, and actually becoming like a check and balance to the leadership that we are having. It's upon the leaders to know that this group of people, we are talking of majority of the 35% of the population, they are not going to let it go. So literally incorporate them, incorporate their ideas for where they are going. They are all struggling or trying to see a better nation, a better continent.
Omar, there are some people who have argued that most of us in Africa really have been occupying space, despite the fact that Africa is not poor. Africa is incredibly blessed with wealth, the type of wealth that, in fact, has helped to build superpowers. There is a book by a former, the late Walt Rodney, an intellectual that came from the Caribbean. The book was titled How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. You could actually have probably even said, he could have said how Africa developed Europe. And now we're talking about this development tiger in China. Guess where they get their resources to be the number two largest economy on this planet Earth? From Africa. So what is it? What's wrong with Africa?
I think, unfortunately, I have to agree with that person. The fact is
Walter
that...
Walter Rodney.
Yes.
Guyana.
The fact is that as an African, we have not taken the conscience that this is us, this is our things, and this is for us to develop it. And going back to what Mary was saying, is in relation to the colonialist mentality. That's about it. And I think the salute will come from than younger people because they don't have those inhibition that we have due to the fact that we have been associated with the colonialism and then with the quote-unquote master. They don't have those inhibition and they know what is going on. So I think we would be probably be empowering our young and probably will be better off at this point.
Any particular reason why the present generation has not made a dent, really? Because let's face it, the current generation, for the most part, is made up of those types of people that you are describing.
Yes. I mean, we can spend the whole day here talking about that because there is also the concept of development that have to be put into place. That we know. And we do not appropriate ourselves, our own development. We want to develop on a model of others, basically. So therefore, it's kind of hard for you to apply somebody else's model and expect to have his results.
I see. Mary?
Yes, please. I think what he's saying is actually what I would tend to support is that the young people, when we are talking of the effect does not simply just get out of people quickly. But at least we are seeing young people now saying, oh, while Africa, we used to say, if what is happening in Rwanda does not pertain to me in Congo, because I'm not part of that, or what is happening to Congo, I care less if I'm from Uganda. We are seeing a generational which is trying to build unity, mm-hmm. which was not there. So they are realizing that they can't achieve much until they are united. So slowly, those mentalities will go away. I have high hopes.
Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally, but I certainly wish you the best.
Thank you.
Good
thank
luck.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Voice of America is also saddened to report the passing on Monday of Dr. Professor Suleiman Nyang. Nyang was a regular contributor to many of our television and radio programs over the years, appearing many times on Straight Talk Africa, In Focus, and Africa 54. He was a superb analyst, offering insight into some of our most complex and high-profile stories. Professor Nyang was a former chairman of the African Studies Department at Howard University here in Washington, D.C., and he served as a deputy ambassador and head of chancery of the Gambian Embassy in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Nyang also authored many, many books, writing extensively on Islamic African and Middle Eastern affairs. He suffered a stroke last year and had been ailing since then. He was 74 years old. On that note, thanks to our guests and thanks to our field stations, along with our viewers and listeners. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning is Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.